wonder if you know a hymn and whether you could sing it with me. Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love, the fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above. Let me read you the second line, the second stanza of that hymn. Before our Father's throne, we pour our ardent prayers. Our fears, our hopes, our aims are one, our comfort and our cares. That's what we do in our prayer time each week. We share those things so that those are not individually held, but corporately held, that we pray for each other and encourage each other. Here's the third stanza. And as I read this for you, I want you to think of Dan Shreve, who is ending his period of active service as a deacon for our class, and think of the other deacons who continue. We share each other's woes, our mutual burdens bear, and often for each other flows the sympathizing tear. Now, listen to the fourth verse and think about our dear friends George and Emma. When we asunder part, it gives us inward pain, but we shall still be joined in heart and hope to meet again. We're going to take a minute. Kitty's going to talk a moment or two about Dan's service and appreciation for him. Barbara's going to say a word or two for George and him.
Dan tells me that he has been a deacon since he was in his 20s, so, you know, that's like 20 years or so. But when he was in his 20s, and it was here at Bon Air Baptist, so we can see even at that point, Bon Air was concerned about mejor mañana, although they had never thought of that phrase, because young people then were being prepared to be leaders to assure that today we would have appropriate leadership. So that was very encouraging to me. In this class, we have a lot of deacons, but some of them serve, some of us serve as members to this class, and others are called on-call deacons, and they serve members who are not enrolled in Sunday school. Then there are others that serve as small group deacons, and I know at least one of our deacons serves in the ministry Hearts for the Homebound. So we serve in many different ways. But about 10 years ago, I think, deacons started being assigned out of their Sunday school class. And Dan was in this class, and he would have been in that original group that had the discovery class. And at the same time, probably Wayne Freeland and maybe Paige was one of those original deacons. Jim Gore, I'm sure, was. And then Dan was, too. And he's worked with this class ever since then. Some of those deacons have gone inactive that were original. And except for Ralph Fenton, he's still hanging in there. He was from the original group. As Dan steps down from being an active deacon, the people that he serves mostly will be picked up by Paul Fernald, but some of you will be spread around, and you'll hear about who your deacon is if Dan is already your deacon. I've had a chance to work with Dan on a project that we do every quarter, and it's kind of a frustrating job in a way, and Rita can attest to, because she joined with us last week as she's taken over this job, she can attest to his calm spirit. No matter how frustrated we got with losing all of our work on the computer, Dan was just as calm, flappable, and he is always that way, and I have enjoyed working with him so much, and we appreciate so much the way that Dan has served this class, and especially his willingness to serve the Lord in this way.
Certainly
have blessed us. This is for you,
thank
you. If you have it signed
and
I'll leave it back here.
I think you are
leaving.
Thank you all.
Sorry to leave you.
All of you have been a great blessing to us.
There's another little remembrance from the church that we think you might enjoy having. Thank you for all you've added to our class.
Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above. Whether we're together, whether we're serving each other, or whether we're separated and perhaps we'll have a chance to see each other in other days. This is a good song to keep in our minds. Now, I want to continue what we've been doing the last couple of weeks, which is to look in Scripture for some things that speak to the nature of music. And it's going to be a little more tenuous than what we have talked about so far, but I do think it's appropriate. I do think it fits and works. So the question I want to put before you is, do you know the chapter, 1 Corinthians 13?
Yes.
We went to a wedding yesterday, and Elliot was playing the organ. Some students that I have gotten to know a little bit were getting married. Most of the offensive line off of Richmond's national championship football team were among the groomsmen or the groom himself. And so the whole chapel sort of shook a little bit as they walked down the aisle. They decided to have a New Testament reading by a young man who looked to be about 13 or 14. And they had an Old Testament reading from the grandmother of the bride. I think I have it backwards. The grandmother of the bride did the New Testament reading. She read from 1 Corinthians 13. What's the subject of 1 Corinthians 13?
Love.
Have you ever thought about why 1 Corinthians 13 is where it is? Because what I want to do is try today to enlarge your sense of why 1 Corinthians 13 appears where it does. If you know something about numbers, you will be able to answer this question with alacrity and ease. What chapter would be right before 1 Corinthians 13?
12.
Very good. And right after would be?
14.
Okay. The subject of 1 Corinthians 12 is spiritual gifts. The subject of 1 Corinthians 13 is love. That is not an accident. Because what had happened was, in the church at Corinth, divisions had appeared. And the divisions that seemed to be the sharpest centered around spiritual gifts. That's why Paul was talking about this. He was not talking about it because he thought spiritual gifts were wonderful, although I'm sure he did. He was talking about it because spiritual gifts for that church had become a problem. Do you know why? Because some people in the church were saying, look at my spiritual gift, it's so much better than yours. And that was deadly, and he knew it. And he wrote 1 Corinthians 13 to say, you can have all the gifts you want. That's why the front of 1 Corinthians 13 reads the way it does. Though I have this, though I have this, though I have this, if I don't have love, it's meaningless, it's worthless. And the phrase that's used that introduces that chapter, the last phrase of chapter 12, I think, you can check and see if I'm right. I haven't looked at this in the last 2 hours. I think that last phrase is, set your mind, set your hearts on the higher gifts. And the highest gift, he says, is love. If you don't have love, the spiritual gifts you have get not exercised, but inflicted on people. And what had happened in that church was, some people had a spiritual gift, and they thought it was the greatest spiritual gift to have, and they felt so sorry for or looked down their noses at people who didn't have that one. And so when you read 1 Corinthians 12, Paul begins to put this into context. If you want to know the great chapters on spiritual gift, they're both chapter 12. It's Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12. And in those places, Paul talks about the gifts that come as being something like parts of our body. How ridiculous, he said, for the foot to say to the eye, I don't need you, or for the eye to say to the foot, I don't need you. You need the parts you got. And he begins to talk about God placing the parts in the body so the body will function the way the body is supposed to do, therefore placing the people in the body of Christ so that the body of Christ functions the way it should function. That's part, George, Emma, of why it hurts. Because a part is being taken away. And there's a part that's valuable here. Now, what I want to do is I want to walk with you through 1 Corinthians 14, which kind of summarizes this. In order to do this, I want to make sure you know what the big problem spiritual gift was. The big problem spiritual gift was speaking in tongues. Paul is not criticizing speaking in tongues. He's simply saying when you elevate a spiritual gift above all others, especially when you elevate that particular one above all others, some problems creep in. And so that's what I want to do, is I want us to look at 1 Corinthians 14. So if you'll find that, look at verse 1. Make love your aim, but be eager too for spiritual gifts, especially for prophesying. You can almost sense that Paul says love is not a spiritual gift. Love is what binds all the spiritual gifts together and makes them function within the body. Love is the connection. Love is the glue. And everybody has that. Make love your aim, but be eager too for spiritual gifts and especially for prophesying. Now, prophesying is an older word which in the context here needs a little bit of explanation. The word prophesying as understood here, I believe, means what you and I would call teaching and preaching, as well as what we might also refer to by that word. That is, that word has become very limited in our minds, where what it means is being able to speak for God or on behalf of God or to help people understand what God is and what He is saying. So he is saying spiritual gifts that have to do with teaching and preaching and those kinds of things of being able to speak God's word, those are the more important ones. Well, speaking in tongues is that as well. And so that's the contrast that you're going to see in this section. You ready? Verse 2. Those who speak in a tongue speak to God, but what? Not to anybody else. Because nobody understands what they're saying. They are speaking in the Spirit, and the meaning is hidden. On the other hand, someone who prophesies, someone who teaches or preaches, speaks to other people, building them up and giving them, my translation says, encouragement and reassurance. Yours says comfort and strengthening. Comfort and strengthening. Exhortation and consolation. Those don't work as well for me as some of the other words do. Those who speak in a tongue, I'm now at verse 4, may build themselves up, but those who teach and preach do what? They build up the community, it says. If yours says church, that's probably a good translation. Build up the community of the faith. While I would like you all to speak in tongues, I would much rather that you could preach and teach. Since those who preach and teach, I'm using that instead of prophesy, are of greater importance than those who speak in tongues, unless, what? The ones who speak in tongues can do what? Interpret what they say so that the church is built up by. Now let's pause for just a minute and see where we are. There's all kinds of spiritual gifts. What's the glue that binds them all together? What's the piece that makes them work? Love. And if you don't have that, it doesn't matter what spiritual gift you have. And Paul is in essence saying those who have had the gift of speaking in tongues and have been elevating it above the others, they are not doing that out of love. They've lost the glue. Does he say that people shouldn't speak in tongues?
No.
Absolutely not. What does he say? I think it'd be great if everybody spoke in tongues. But what did he say? There's something better. Somebody who can speak a word that the people can understand, if it's a word that comes from God, people are going to be built up by it. The community is going to be stronger. People who speak in tongues build themselves up, people who preach and teach, build up the church, build up the community. Okay? Verse 6. Now suppose, brothers, I come to you and speak in tongues. What good shall I do you if my speaking provides no revelation or knowledge or prophecy or instruction? Revelation, knowledge, prophecy, instruction. That's a pretty good list for what prophesy means as a spiritual gift, I think. Suppose I come to you and speak in tongues. What good shall I do you if my speaking provides no revelation or knowledge or prophecy or instruction? And now we're back to music. Have you read the next verse? Imagine or think about an inanimate musical instrument. If it does not make any distinction between notes, how can one recognize what is being played on flute or lyre? What did we learn last week was flute and lyre. Those are one of the main musical instruments that we see associated with worship. What was the other one? Okay. Harp might have been a synonym for lyre. Cymbal, I think, was the other one. And who played the trumpets?
The priest
did. Okay, you're remembering this, right? If it does not make any distinction between notes, a musical instrument, how can one recognize what is being played on flute or lyre? If the trumpet sounds a call, who plays the trumpet?
Priests.
Now, that sounds like a military situation, right? Bugle calls for the cavalry and all this kind of stuff. But what they're saying is, priests play the trumpets. Trumpets are bringing a word to the people, or letting the people know there is a word. If the trumpet sounds a call which is unrecognizable, who's going to get ready for the attack? Are you aware of bugle calls in the U.S. Army back in the day? Years and years ago, my grandfather did something I still find absolutely remarkable. I think I've told enough of you about this. This is going to be old hat to three quarters of you. Around 1946, 1947, he had four boys and four girls at that moment. The sixth of his children was getting married. This was a guy who had been off serving in World War II. He was getting married. He realized just a few more years, all of his children would be gone. And he recognized they were going to be disconnecting from each other if something wasn't done. And he said to them, okay, you write me a letter once a week. And at the end of the week, I'll sit down with your letters and I'll write a summary so that everybody knows what's happening with everybody else. I'll add news of the hometown where all of you grew up, and I'll send that letter back out to you. And he did that faithfully every week until his death in 1969. 23 years, he wrote a letter a week. He wrote it on very, very, very thin paper with carbon paper because there weren't any photocopy machines in those days. Okay? And my grandmother preserved the last copy. Okay. I've gone through with some help, edited those, and published those for my cousins and my uncles and aunts, so everybody has a copy of that now. Back in the middle 50s, he started including with each week's letter, on an irregular basis, a much longer thing that he called I Remember When. And this was multiple pages for each chapter or episode, but he talked about religious services, he talked about schools, he talked about light, because he had been born at a time when there was no machinery, there was no electricity, there was no artificial light of any kind. And he talked about how light worked. One of his chapters was on sound. He lived in a world that was full of sound, but it was the sound of the brooks and the wind and the trees and the birds and maybe the rustle of animals or the sound of your own walking. When a people on his farm needed to let somebody on another farm know that something was wrong, what would they do? They'd halloo, he said. They had some kind of sound that sounded a lot like hello, but it would carry across a great distance. And from farm to farm, they'd let them know something's wrong, we need to come help. Okay. They're talking about sound in a military situation. You play a bugle and all of a sudden that sound will carry. People are supposed to know what to do. What happens if the bugle call is not intelligible, if it can't be understood? The army's not going to know what to do. If a trumpet sounds a call which is unrecognizable, who's going to get ready for the attack? It's the same with you. I just moved to verse 9. Did you? It's the same with you. If you do not use your tongue to produce speech that can be readily understood, how can anyone know what you're saying? You will be talking to the air. How does yours render that particular sentence? You will be speaking into the air.
Uh-huh.
However, many the languages used in the world, all of them use sound. Have you guys read this chapter before or recently? There's a lot here. All of the languages, however many used in the world, all of them use sound. But if I do not understand the meaning of the sound, I'm a barbarian. George, I'm a barbarian. You can speak in Romanian. Judith's got French under control. Kitty's got Spanish under control. And from time to time, you guys help us. If I don't understand the meaning of the sound, I am a barbarian to the person who is speaking, and the speaker is a barbarian to me. Do you realize that? Do you understand the use of that word? Barbarian means there is a cultural divide. There's a communication divide between us so vast that we hardly can know each other.
This is
foreigner. Yours just says a foreigner.
Mm-hmm.
So with you, as you are eager to have spiritual powers, aim to be rich in the spiritual powers that build up the community. That is why anyone who speaks in a tongue must pray that he may be given the interpretation. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit may be praying. This is a fascinating verse. But my mind derives no fruit from it. What then? I'll pray with the spirit, but I'll pray with my mind as well. We're back to music on this next phrase. I will sing praises in the spirit, but I'll also sing praises with my mind. Otherwise, if you say your blessing only with the spirit, how is an uninitiated person going to answer amen to your thanksgiving when they don't understand what you're saying? You may be making your thanksgiving well, but the other person is not built up. Not at all. I thank God that I speak with tongues more than any of you. All the same, when I'm in the assembly, I would rather say 5 words with my mind to instruct others as well than 10,000 words in a tongue. Brothers, do not remain children in your thinking, infants in wickedness. It says in the written law, in strange tongues and in a foreign language, I will talk to this nation, but even so they will refuse to listen. So then strange languages are significant, not for believers, but for unbelievers. Whereas on the other hand, preaching and teaching is not for unbelievers, it's for believers. Suppose the whole congregation were meeting and all of them speaking in tongues and some uninitiated person or unbelievers were to come in. Don't you think they would say that you were all raving lunatics? Mm-hmm. What does yours say at that point? Mad. But if you were preaching and teaching when an unbeliever or someone uninitiated came in, he would find himself put to the test and judged by all and the secrets of his heart revealed, and so he would fall down on his face and worship God, declaring God indeed is among you. So what should it be like, brothers, when you come together? There's the question I want to ask you this morning. The whole of this chapter is pointing to that question, in my opinion. What should our worship be like? We have a traditional service. We have the gathering. And we could, if we look at examples across sister churches, we could probably have 5 or 10 or 15 other ways of doing worship. What should our worship be like? What's Paul's answer? He takes no stand that I can see on style. Where does he take a stand? On intelligibility. On the people who are there being able to understand what's being done, why it's being done, what's being said, and what it means. Or at least having the words offered in such a way that if the Spirit wanted to work with those words in the heart and mind of that person who was present, the Spirit would have something to work with. When you come together, each of you brings a psalm or some instruction or a revelation or speaks in a tongue or gives an interpretation. Let all these things be done in a way that builds up the community. If there is to be someone speaking in a tongue, let there be only one or two, or at most three, and those one at a time, and let one of those interpret. If there's no interpreter, may I paraphrase? Shut up. I think that's pretty close. If there is no interpreter, let each of them be quiet in the assembly and speak only to himself and God. Let two prophets, teachers, and preachers speak, while the rest weigh their words. And if a revelation comes to someone who is sitting by, the speaker should stop speaking. You can all prophesy, teach, and preach, but one at a time. Then all will learn something and receive encouragement. The prophetic spirit is to be under the prophet's control, under the teacher's control, for God is a God not of disorder, but of peace. What should our worship be like? I do not believe Paul takes a stand on style. Where does he take a stand? Worship ought to work. What happens ought to build up the body. If a hymn builds up the body, we ought to sing hymns. If a praise song builds up the body, we ought to sing praise songs. God's word ought to be part of it. It should be read, and it should be commented on. And when we leave worship, what should we feel? We should feel built up. Been to worship services where you walked out feeling torn down? I can remember a few. Walked out of a worship service feeling lifted up. I can remember some of those too. So there you have it. That's what I want us to talk about. Music is a piece of it, but more than anything, music is a part of a larger function, which is worship. And we can't, I think, talk about worship, talk about music, unless we talk about the role of music in worship and talk about worship itself.
Yeah. Over here, where we're talking about speaking in spirit, in tongues, and all that sort of thing, and it says that the greatest of these is love. How can someone have those gifts and express them if they don't feel love? I mean, if it's all about pride, why does it work?
Well, let me say again, as I read through this section, I see Paul's description of love. That's why 1 Corinthians 13 is located where it is.
Yeah.
I see him talking about love not as a spiritual gift that some possess and that others don't. I see him speaking of love as something that makes all the spiritual gifts function and work. And I see him at the first of chapter 13 saying, if you have this aspect of a spiritual gift, but you don't have love, it's not doing anything.
You still have the ability to speak in tongues, whether you have love or not.
He seems to be saying people can, and this is my word for it, people can exercise a spiritual gift, or they can inflict a spiritual gift. And I really think those two verbs are useful in this context. The infliction of a spiritual gift means somebody has it, but they haven't figured out yet what to do with it. Okay? Typically, that's for someone who is less far along their Christian walk. After a while, they start to realize, you know, the spiritual gift I've been given isn't a source of pride for me. It's a source of accomplishment and work within the kingdom. I've been given something I can contribute. And if you do it out of pride, if you exercise a spiritual gift out of pride, it comes off as inflicted, I think. Okay. Chris?
I don't think the Baptist church has said anything about speaking in tongues. It is a much of a gun. The only time I saw it was because a lot of confusion in the church. I didn't see that.
I think we have to go there. I think there is controversy within the church right now. I think the controversy in part is because of what happened back here. I think many folks out of not just Baptist but evangelical circles look on this as something to be suspicious of because of the way it can be used. I think right now there are some things going on, at least in the press that I read and the reports that I read, both within the Baptist circles and larger. There is a sense in which if people speak in tongues, they are criticized. I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. I think that's not, I think, scriptural. I think what is scriptural is if you're speaking in tongues, you need to be careful what you do and how you do it. And I think the admonition that's coming from this section is if you're doing that and there's nobody there to interpret, that's not something public, that's something private. People are still being criticized, as I understand it, when they speak of, I do speak in tongues, I do it privately. Some folks are still being criticized. I think that's wrong. But I do think it's been done. What I think Paul is saying here is what is done in corporate settings needs to be done in such a way that the body is built up. And speaking in tongues itself does not do that unless there's somebody there to interpret what's being said. And I think what little I know about circles in which speaking in tongues is a part of corporate worship, I don't think interpretation is often a part of that. But I'm ignorant enough to where I'm not sure of that. Baptists, I think, historically have been suspicious of this, if not condemning of this. Suspicious, I think, is probably okay. Condemning, I think, crosses a line. Allison?
Since you're on your English ground.
Yeah, would you like to borrow it for your statement?
No, I'm going to let you hang on. Since spiritual gifts is kind of a conversation we're having in the church, and you stopped.
You read on, didn't you? You read verse 34, didn't you?
You want to know what the next three verses are supposed to mean.
Okay. Can I ask you a question first? Do you think I haven't thought about that? This is an answer from me. This is not anything received or inspired unless it turns out that your heart resonates with it. Okay. Verse 26, let all these things be done in a way that will build up the community. Verse 24, if you were all prophesying, preaching, and teaching when an unbeliever or someone uninitiated came in, he would find himself put to the test by all and judged by all, and the secrets of his heart revealed, and he would fall down on his face and worship God, declaring that God is indeed among you. I have a picture that in this world at this time, at the time this was written, that having a woman speak in a public place would have shut down communication with unbelievers. And I believe that what Paul was saying was, when we have public and corporate worship where unbelievers come in, we want to try to make sure that what we do is done in a way that they will remain open to what God is trying to say. I don't know that that particularly satisfies me. There's a sense of power that I have seen when women have spoken in teaching and preaching settings. I know that there are persons in this room who have great power in that direction. But I think if this is something that is used to silence folks like that today, that's an aberration and that's something awful. If it's something that reports what was a fact in that day, then I think maybe that's a different thing. I don't think this is something that says for us today we need to have women never speak. I think what it says was in the churches that he was writing to. And that's the tightrope you walk when you read something. It has a meaning and an application to the time when it was written and to the people to whom it was written. Paul did not know he was writing something for the ages, I think. Paul knew that there were churches that he loved, people in those churches that he loved, who were struggling to find God's way, and he was writing to help them. It turns out what he wrote helps lots of people in lots of ages. This particular one, I think, is aimed at a particular time and place. But that's a judgment call.
I just think it's unfortunate because I think those who do not take it in that context and there have used it.
This has been used to silence women in our day in a way that I think is I'm standing firmly on my sign. I think it's misused when it's used that way.
Was the early Christian church as divided as the Jewish church, men on one side and women outside that? I don't know.
My grandfather's church was when he was growing up. When he talked about religious services, that's the description he gave. It was a big day, he said, when a young man walked from the women's side to the men's side to take his place with the men, because it was a signal he had grown up. The Jewish folks had their bar mitzvah. The Baptist church in McPheeters Bend, East Tennessee, had their moment where the 13 or 14-year-old boy walked across the aisle. Yeah, it was divided in the early 1900s. I suspect it was divided then.
But there are still countries and religions that still are that prehistoric about how women...
You're gonna need my sign if you're gonna say prehistoric, because again, we've got brothers and sisters who feel very strongly this has a meaning for today, and they think they know what it is. I respectfully disagree with that. Who's the best preacher among Billy Graham's children? Ann Luck. It's the girl. I don't know if I saw somebody else's hand, George.
Just in support of what you said, which is the main thing, whatever is done to be done with love. Love not for myself, love for my brothers and sisters. And just a reminder about dangerous ground. You have to search or to be aware that there are other spirits that might do the same thing. But only the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, is the one who gives you the gifts we are talking about. Mm-hmm. And God is love, and the Spirit of God is love. So if everything that is manifested with love to edify, build up the church, encourage, and so on, then it is okay. Otherwise, it's not okay because there is no love. But still, I like very much that there is also a warning about it. First Thessalonians, be careful how you talk about it, because if you don't really understand, just stay away. So better keep it silent and ask, Lord, I don't understand, and the Lord will not punish you for not understanding.
And Allison, just to add one thing to that, I'm not prepared to go through the specifics today, but if you go through Paul's letters and look at his acknowledgement section, at the end of most of his letters, he talks about people that he's thankful for and prays for, and there are women among whom in that group who are identified as co-laborers with me in the Lord, working the same work I do in the same ways I do, and there are women in that group. He talks about church leaders. He uses a word which most translations made by folks who don't want women to be of service will not translate this way, but it's the same word that's used for deacon. And there's other places like that. So that when you read the New Testament, you find a conflict, and the conflict, as I resolve it, is these are speaking, this one is speaking to corporate settings where unbelievers might be present, not to situations where you might be small. And the aim of all of it goes back, I think, to verse 25. There are going to be unbelievers present at these, and what we do needs to be done in such a way that they will benefit and strengthen from that. I don't want you to take your eyes off the larger issue. The larger issue is the place of worship, of music within the setting of worship. That's what we're trying to look at. But I do think it's here. And if you hadn't brought it up, I would have taken us another verse or two later in the morning. Lloyd, did I see your hand?
I was just going to say that I've always felt that Paul, some things about his culture that he would have liked to take on, he didn't. In Ephesians, he says, slaves obey your masters, even though they were both part of the church. And women, even though they were a key part of his ministry, he didn't take on the culture, the vibe of that day in the letters that he wrote. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that is a model for today. The model for today, the culture we live in, is quite different. But even he focused on the battles. He couldn't battle everything. He needed to build up the church.
And I think there was also a sense that he had that Jesus was coming much, much sooner, and that some of those battles, important though they might be on the long term, were not that important on the short term. We have a short time before Jesus comes back. Let's save all we can. I don't know, Allison, it's a complicated section. It's a complicated section. Thank you for speaking to that.
I just think it's important to kind of acknowledge it, because I think, you know, we're talking about different worship styles, and that's it. It's really important to, you know, it's perpetuated in the right way.
It is a current issue. Yes.
It is a current issue, yes.
Well, I was going to say, you know, when Lloyd...
Anybody wants to borrow my sign?
Yeah, I'm just saying, maybe I should be standing on this. But I think, you know, what you were saying, Lloyd, about it being a cultural issue, I mean, even within the context of today, it is a cultural issue.
Right.
I mean, we have been involved with groups through homeschooling that, you know, that they take this literally. And... You know, and you know something, I think you have to go back to what it says in verse 22 about these things being a sign, not necessarily for believers, but for unbelievers. You know, there's a place for these different ways of seeing things, I think. You know, I mean, I'm not willing to put God in a box and say we all have to look the same, because they're going to meet somebody's need that I am not going to meet. And, you know, far be it from me to say that they should not be approaching things that way, because they may be bringing the Lord to somebody that I can never ever bring the Lord to.
Comments about the central issue, or about this issue, which is an important side issue? This is your chance.
Bill, I have my grandma's obituary, which happens to be in my Bible, and Mrs. Margaret, she was the widow of Reverend Eldridge. She, even in 1961, did not think women should speak in church.
I would hate to imagine not having had the chance to hear some of the things I have heard spoken, I'm convinced, in God's spirit, by godly women. In the places, in public places, corporate places, Sunday school classes, in other places. I hate to think of what I would have lost if I had not had that. I think God speaks through His people. I think there was a day, I think there still is a day, where some people find offense in things that I don't find offense in. Let me remind you also, still in this context, it was Paul who said, if I'm hungry, I'll eat meat and I won't ask where it came from. But if I'm in the presence of someone who is offended by eating meat that has been offered to an idol, then I will refrain. He said, it's not a big deal to me, but if it's a big deal to them, then I'll adjust the way I do. I don't have to, but I'll adjust in order to try not to put barriers or blockages between that person and God. I think this is in that context. I'm standing on my sign when I say it.
Yeah, I realized throughout the New Testament here, you've got women who were spokesmen, who did things too. And, I mean, with the deacons, I mean, you've got women in there who play a part. So that's, in a way, it's kind of contrary.
Well, let me take a step further down that road. If you go to Acts 16, I think that's the right place, there's a fascinating change in the use of pronouns during that chapter. Now, before I go any further, let me make sure all of you understand. There's a 1 Corinthians and a 2 Corinthians. There's a 1 Thessalonians and a 2 Thessalonians. There is a 1 and 2 within the Gospels. The Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts are volume 1, volume 2. The book of John comes in between, because the book of John was written later, and the people who put the Bible together decided they want the Gospels together. Okay? Brother Luke wrote those things. In chapter 16 of Acts, in the first part of the chapter, you read, they did this, they did this, they did this, they did this. All of a sudden, they're getting ready to go to Macedonia. The Gospel is entering Europe. It's heading towards us. And all of a sudden, the pronoun changes to we. That's when Dr. Luke joined them. When they walk into Macedonia, when they walk into Europe, there are three converts very, very quickly. A good Jewish man like Paul would have prayed every morning, because this is what good Jewish men did. Thank God I am not a woman, I am not a Gentile, and I'm not a slave. You know who the first three converts were in Europe? A woman, a Gentile, and a slave. I think God's got a sense of humor. I think God's got a sense of humor. I think for Paul, there were some things that were more comfortable and some things less. But I think what Paul said about eating meat serves to idols probably fits with this. You're going to go into corporate worship, you're going to have unbelievers there. If the unbelievers would simply stop listening if a woman spoke, then maybe a woman shouldn't speak. That's what I think is going on. But that's I'm standing on my sign, take it for what it's worth. Okay?
The church is not stagnant, it's dynamic. And it's going to...
Some churches are.
Well, I'm sorry. Yes. But I'm talking about the church. Christ Church is that way.
There are some things you hold on to like rocks.
Right.
There are some things that are fungible.
That's a foundation.
And it's real tough sometimes for some churches to figure out which one's which. We have very little time left. In fact, we're on negative time now. But, Carol.
I just keep thinking about two friends I have, both women missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And one that served in Africa for 28 years. Alone, out in the wilderness, and first as a nurse with Aborigine type people, and then the last few years teaching in a small village, and she's home now. She retired. She did so much good. The Lord really helped. And then another person I'm thinking of is a friend. That's a woman that's down in Honduras now, and she's been down there for about 25 years, and she started out with Child Evangelism Fellowship here in Richmond, and she's been down there now setting up churches alone, but then she teaches the men to take over, and then she worked and setting up, she's working and setting up Sunday schools throughout the country. And has, you know, been invited in Nicaragua now. And she's a woman alone. And she's 59. And she's taught men, but they take over. Am I making sense?
Yeah. I think if you believe that God is prepared to have half of the people not be able to speak for Him in a public setting, God bless you. I'm not going to go there. I think... too many times in the Bible, I see evidence that a group of people says, well, God can't possibly use this person to do that. And God says, no, I can't. Acts chapter 1 or chapter 2, Judas is dead. The disciples get together and say, you know, we really are supposed to have 12. We've lost one. We need a 12th. Do you remember how they chose the 12th? They rolled dice. They rolled dice. They named two, and then they said, okay, God, which of these two? I think if God had been asked at that moment, who do you think we ought to use? They would have said, remember that guy Saul that's been yelling at everything? The guy who was grinning his head off at the crucifixion? Because I have a sneaky feeling Paul was around for that. Remember him? He's the one. And what would the disciples have said? You're out of your mind. But as time came, Paul identified himself as an apostle appointed not by men, but by God. The most unlikely person that could ever be. If you think there's somebody or some group of people that God cannot use, I think that's a dangerous place to stand. I think I got a better place to stand. God can use anybody. He may not, but He could. Bob, you get the final word. We're almost done.
We have seen that this is a legitimate biblical truth. We have quite a sizable group of consecrated Christian Baptists in this room. I can't hear everybody that says everything, but I have not heard anybody in this room say, I have the gift of speaking in tongues. If there is a person in this room who has that gift, and doesn't mind saying a word to us about the experience of having it, I would love to hear it.
There's a good point. Is there anyone who would like to speak? This has just become a Quaker meeting. I will say again, there are people who do, and some of those people have my admiration for who they are and what they do. Blessed be.
I don't have the gift, but I have been prayed over by people who speak in tongues.
So blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian life. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above. You all have a good day.
Can I see up here?